crazy it seems to have a dream to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you today? I'm doing okay. I am here to tell you that I accept the results. I accept the results of the election. I've done a lot of reading. I've done a lot of research. I've talked to friends from all over. And at the end of the day, I am willing to accept and endorse that Sandra Masters is the mayor of Regina, Saskatchewan. Congratulations, Ms. Masters. This is great news. First mayor ever, not first mayor ever for Regina, first female mayor ever elected in the city of Regina, my old hometown. So there you go. Probably not what you were thinking. Hey, see what I did there? But anyways, yeah, she campaigned like all mayors of Regina throughout history have campaigned on whether or not to raise property taxes. Basically, no to raising them, no to cutting services. You know, that's what they do. It's like, it's got to be the simplest or the most difficult election to win because everybody always says the same thing. But through my entire 50-some years when I lived in Regina, the only issue ever was property taxes in 50 years. Hard to believe. Today on the show, Chris Stafferton is here. Chris Stafferton, the bread architect, the gluten-free baker and author from Tasmania, Australia, is here on the show. We had a really, really good talk, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. Before that, though, I want to ask you a question. How are you doing? How's things? This COVID has been going on for, 8 months now? Seriously, 8 months, 7 months for sure. And, you know, I think folks are starting to really feel the pinch. You know, when back in April, and I did a few shows about talking to people about, you know, closing their bakeries and rethinking their bakeries and redesigning things and trying to kind of make do during the COVID. And folks still are doing a great job, but the cracks are starting to form. A couple of folks on Bakers for Bakers have been talking about just how hard it is, you know, 8 months later to try and keep things afloat. I saw a news article with Joanne Chang, who's been on the show, talking about how, you know, like this can't go on like this forever. Like restaurants especially are suffering hard. And so I try and keep an optimistic tone on the show because I think there's so much potential and I'm just such a great fan of bakeries. But that doesn't mean that folks aren't hurting. And so I hope you're doing okay. Both business-wise, especially mentally and physically, and I think if you're struggling, I want to make the offer again. Come on and sign up for Bakers for Bakers. That's bakers4bakers.org, because we're having some good discussions over there about, you know, what the heck do we do in these times, and you know, it's not like there's an easy formula that do this and everything will work out. But by sharing your experiences, good and bad, with others in the community, we can all get better and we can all get our businesses either back afloat or staying afloat during these crazy times. Another couple of stories for you before the big chat. I think I found my happy place here in Victoria. I really do. And when I opened myself up to finding the happy place, I found two within 2 weeks. Serious true. Let's check this out. So 2 weeks ago, or maybe 3 weeks ago now, Cindy and I finally took a Sunday and walked to a little bakery cafe, oh, maybe 10 minutes from our place, 15-minute walk from our place, and it's called Imagine Studio, and we'd been by it a whole bunch of times, but it's always been closed because we go to the fish and chip shop that's next door quite a bit, but we go later in the evening when Imagine Studio is closed. But we went on a Sunday afternoon, went there for, picked up a couple things to eat and a coffee for me and a hot chocolate for Cindy. And they still had three tables open, so very spaced out and sequestered, but we sat at one table. And it was just the greatest thing. Just a beautiful, looks like an old house that's been kind of cut back to the studs and redesigned and stuff. And there's a nice kitchen in the back and a really nice display case and good baking, good food, you know, good kind of lunch fare and snacks and stuff and good coffee and tea. And over in the corner, there's a brand spanking new pizza oven, like an Italian, you know, metal on the outside prefabricated pizza oven that's not connected up yet. The chimney's not connected up and through the roof yet. And so I sucked it up and I went and I said, is the owner of this place here? I'd like to introduce myself. And Dorothy, the owner, was there. And so we had a really good chat. And I introduced myself and I complimented her on her place and on the oven. And I said, how can I help? And she's like, oh, wow. It would be nice to have some help getting this oven going and getting it kind of into the swing of things with the other things that they're doing at the cafe. And so I'm going to give them a hand because I've got quite a few years of brick oven baking experience. I'm going to give them a hand, you know, getting this pizza oven fired up and going and try and see what we can bake in there for flatbreads and stuff in addition to doing pizzas. So I got to meet their head baker and stuff, and she's delightful. And so I have a little fun side project helping a place that I've instantly smitten with, helping them get a new line of business going. So that's kind of fun and really nice place. And the thing I didn't mention about Imagine Studio is that Dorothy's whole reason for running the place is to give at-risk youth their first jobs, really. So everybody that works there, it's their first job. They're learning everything from first principles, and she's trying to, you know, give them the skills to go and be able to make a living for themselves. And so it's going to be a really neat place to spend some time. So that was kind of fun. And then the next week, Cindy says, well, I was walking or biking by this place and I just saw a sign outside that said bread, you know, in the windows. And so we should go check that out. So it's about a 15-minute walk in the opposite direction, sort of up Douglas Street. And we went there last weekend, and the place was called, or is called, Working Culture Bread. Oh my gosh. We walked in and it just totally grabbed my heart because it looked like my old bakery in a way, Orange Boot Bakery, you know, with the open to the back and there's the big oven and a nice little counter, but they've got espresso and super high ceilings in here. And they'd only been open for about 3 weeks. And we got there at about noon or one on a Saturday, and they were already sold out. We got the last two cookies, but they had no bread left or anything. And of course, I tried my best to say hi and show that my interest wasn't too creepy. And I said, oh yeah, you know, we used to have a bakery in Saskatchewan, and the woman at the front, it's a husband and wife team. So the woman at the front was like, oh, well, my husband's from Saskatchewan. Where's your place? I said, oh, well, it's Regina. Oh, well, he's from Regina. And well, what was the name of your bakery? And I said, well, Orange Boot Bakery. And she turns to the back and says, Orange Boot Bakery, to her husband, who's back at the mixer. And he looks at me, says, Orange Boot, right? And so they used to come to the bakery, or he used to come to the bakery, and really enjoyed it and remembered it and was like, saying, oh yeah, well, you know, I was thinking of your place when I set up this place and that kind of a thing. So we made new friends. So we went back up on Saturday and or on Sunday, the next day, tried some bread and and it was excellent, you know, and they're making pretzels and he's even doing pizzas and pizza biancas on Sunday afternoons and stuff. And they'd only been open for about 3 weeks, I guess. So brand new. They had that, they're younger folks, they're in their 30s and, you know, looking exhausted, but looking happy, making really good food, really good bread, really good cookies and stuff. And the building that they're in, they actually live upstairs and the bakery's downstairs. And that sounds awesome to me. So, you know, left him some information and said, hey, if you're getting busy and you need help just, you know, figuring things out or even shaping a bit, give me a call. I'm just down the block. So I'm actually really busy these days, but there's a couple opportunities here to get my hands in some dough or at least do the thing that makes me happiest, which is kind of figuring out systems, you know, figuring out production, figuring out the order of things. How are we going to make it so, you know, you can start putting get your wood-fired oven going and make flatbreads in the middle of all your other production, that kind of stuff. Or in the case of Adam at Working Culture, it's like, you know, how do you double your production when it's just you, right? Because folks are lined up out the door and they love your stuff, so how can you bake more? That kind of thing. So I think that's a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun doing that, so who knows? But I made a couple friends anyways, and if I don't feel like baking my own stuff, I now have two great places to go to in opposite directions from my apartment. So that was pretty neat. So, Chris Stafferton. So Chris is a baker in Tasmania, Australia, and he's a gluten-free baker, a gluten-free bread baker, and he wrote a book last year called Promise and Fulfillment: Formulas for Real Bread Without Gluten. And I remember seeing some posts on Instagram a year ago when the book came out, and I was like, "Oh, this looks really interesting," because Chris's formulas are making what appears through Instagram anyways to, you know, real artisan bread style bread that's 100% gluten-free. And, you know, I'm a pretty decent bread baker, but I don't understand gluten-free at all, really. I've dabbled just the briefest amount, and I've never seen anything that looked like, quote, real bread that was gluten-free. And then he just, you know, kept on showing these pictures of these different types of loaves and stuff that he was making. And then the book came out, and the book has like 60 different formulas for gluten-free bread. And I'm like, whoa, this is higher level. This is beyond what I could even imagine gluten-free bread could look like and hopefully taste like. And so I reached out to Chris to come on the show and talk about it a bit, because I sort of rediscovered him on Instagram a couple of weeks back. And he came on, and we had a really, really good talk about why he's doing this, how he's doing this, what's next, the whole thing. So just to set up the call, the day that we sat down to talk, I had just seen on Instagram that he was hanging gluten-free panettone, you know, hanging it upside down and stuff to let it cool. And so I asked him about that. So right when the call starts, we're talking about the panettone that he had just made, and I think maybe the day before, and had posted up on Instagram. So here we go, from Tasmania, Australia, Chris Stafferton, the bread architect. Very nice to meet you.
And you too.
Yeah, I have to say, I remember seeing, I think it was through Instagram when your book first came out, and I thought, boy, this is really looking interesting and stuff. And so I'm glad we got a chance to chat, for sure. But I wanted to ask, first off, how did that panettone turn out? I saw a picture there.
Hasn't been cut yet.
Look at that, eh? That's lovely.
So it was interesting. Just as I was putting it into the oven,
yeah,
I bumped it and it sank.
Oh, I bet, eh?
And I thought, oh no.
Well,
but it regained its height,
yeah.
But it didn't gain any more.
Oh, okay.
So, okay. Yeah. But anyway,
that's all right. It's still going to be awesome, I bet, for sure.
Oh, it smells brilliant. So I'm just, yeah. Yeah. I think it's this afternoon. I've got an appointment with a friend to go and cut one together and enjoy it.
Oh,
yeah.
Good stuff. What fun. And, yeah. And whereabouts are you located? Are you in Tasmania? Did I get that right?
Yes, okay. Tasmania. Yeah. If you look at the sort of heart shaped state, just at the top in that V is a place called Devonport.
Oh, okay.
And we're in Devonport.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I have a friend, well, in Melbourne that always says you would really like Tasmania. She back when you could travel, she used to go for vacations and stuff. And then, well, and I know Alan Scott was from there, but the oven builder. But I don't.
Yes.
But beyond that and the Hobart cricket team, it's a pretty much unknown place to me. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
It's not a bad place. I came down before I moved down here, years and years ago. I was hitchhiking around the island and teamed up with a guy from it was somewhere on your west coast. I'm just trying to think where he was from now. And while I was absolutely wrapped at the wild country in the West Coast, he said, "Oh, it's normal. Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing special here."
Yeah. Well, I'm relatively new out on the coast here. Like I grew up on the prairies, and so it's still wild and new and interesting to me. Whenever we leave the city here, yeah, it's pretty remarkable when you grow up where the city where I grew up. Every single tree was hand planted because the city was on the prairies. There were no trees natively growing there. They were all planted by people who settled there. And so then to come out and see these massive old growth forests and stuff is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So where are you originally from then, Chris?
I was born and grew up in Melbourne.
Okay.
Which is just
across the way.
Straight. Yeah. Mm.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So I'm really curious. I guess the book is called Bread Architect, I'm sorry.
No, let me fix that.
Please.
The book is called Promise and Fulfillment.
That is true. Yes.
I took the tag Bread Architect, and that's now become the business.
Gotcha. That's true too. Right. Promise and Fulfillment. And I my apologies there. I was curious about the architect word as the choice of word there. What's that mean to you? How did that come up?
When I was a nipper, they tell me at about 4 years old, I decided I wanted to be an architect.
Oh, okay.
And I lived that dream all the way up to finishing high school, starting uni. I did the first year of a course in architecture at the school, which, according to the research I'd done, was the best in the country. Except that year they decided they would rejig the whole course and change it.
Oh, great.
And there were something like 70 of us started the year, 2 of us finished. and that was probably through just sheer bloody-mindedness. the other guy went on to become an architect in Melbourne. I switched during the year. There'd been a presentation by the Centre d'Architecture de la Mer. From Paris, and they were the guys that did the underwater structures for Jacques Cousteau.
Oh, wow.
And that fascinated me. So I thought, oh, I'd love to get into something like that. Because when I was actually in the course doing architecture, I discovered that architecture these days wasn't what I'd imagined it to be. It wasn't form following function and all that sort of thing. It was people who are very clever at design doing fancy designs for somebody else's structure.
Okay.
So they weren't doing the engineering part of it as well. They were just doing the finessing of the design.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So I thought this isn't really what I wanted, but the work that this crowd were doing for Jacques Cousteau was brilliant because it was all of that. Everything was what you saw was what you got. There was no fancy tricks to hide a bit of structure. The structure was the thing, but it was beautifully designed. So I tried to find out how on earth I could do that. There was nothing in Australia. But the closest path I could find was to switch to naval architecture, so ship building design and so on, and try and work out a path through that. Right, I ended up getting into a course in naval architecture. I moved across. That meant moving up to Sydney. I studied naval architecture there. I got a cadetship with the government, but I ended up working in a naval dockyard, and I was working with rust, cracks, and sewage systems.
Glamour job.
So the high dreams of amazing design and so on just didn't happen. So I kept doing that for some years. It was good. It was honest work. It was good being down in the dockyard, rubbing shoulders with people who were just honest, you know, soul to the earth type folks. From there, I moved down to a job in Canberra, which was it was a shipbuilding project job, and it was good. And I ended up in another position where, in naval architecture, I was responsible for an area of ship maintenance policy and all that sort of thing, and that was great. But it just lacked that sort of excitement that I wanted. So I ended up moving around doing a few different things, getting some further qualifications. And I worked in all sorts of other areas, including a bit of systems engineering, systems architecture. And so it goes on. When I started doing the bread stuff many, many years later, I was kicking around for a tag, and I thought, you know, obviously I'm doing bread, but what I'm doing is I'm actually back to that idea of the form follows function and you know, keeping it simple and making a good design from. So I thought, yeah, why not bread architect? And that had a ring to it. And I liked it. The funniest thing was, though, around about a year or so later, wife and I were in Paris on a holiday. I'd already made contact with a guy who ran a boulangerie up near Montmartre, Francois Brault. He also had the tag bread architect. So obviously there was some great conversations there. He had a background in engineering, but also in international banking and something as well. And his path to using bread architect was a little bit different, but it's just fun that, you know, the two of us have got this tag and we get along beautifully well. It's great, yeah. So that's bread architect.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and so when, or I guess, how did you get into the bread side of things? Like when did that become a thing for you?
My first foray into bread was when I was at uni. There was a bread strike in Sydney. I was studying in Sydney. The funny thing is, I've tried historical records to find out more about the bread strike and haven't been able to find out anything. But for about a month, you just couldn't buy bread. Right. Something had happened and it wasn't being baked. So I thought, right, you know, obvious thing is I bake my own. Mm-hmm. So I started doing it. It wasn't very good. But it was where I started baking a little bit of bread. And time moved on. I got married, kids, and I'd bake bread for the family. We used to do a bit of entertaining, so I'd bake dinner rolls and all that sort of thing. And it was acceptable, but it wasn't anything to write home about. And that was a lot of fun. Move on to 2006. My youngest daughter and myself were both told within a few months of each other to go off gluten.
Oh, okay.
The medical thing.
Yeah.
And when it was me, it was, yeah, okay, I've got to go off gluten. What do? I like bread. In fact, you know, I'd grown up loving bread. When we went on holidays, the first thing would be to find the best bakery in town and see what they produced. So it was a bit of a nuisance not to be able to have bread. When my daughter had the same diagnosis, it became a real challenge because it wasn't just sorting out something for me to eat. It was also making sure that she got good food and food that she could enjoy and all of those things. And with kids, yeah, feeding them, it can be difficult at times, as I'm sure you know. Sure. So I took it on as a challenge. And part of my obstinacy is whenever I have something that's a challenge, I really take it up as a hobby and get stuck into it.
Right.
So I worked for some time, not on and off, not consistently every day, but for some time on and off, trying to find some decent bread. And the stuff that was available in packet mixes or from supermarkets was just atrocious. We were on holidays once and we were up in North Queensland. And I asked around about, you know, anybody that baked gluten-free bread, and I was told about this place. Oh, it's brilliant stuff. So we duly went over and ordered a loaf and came back a few days later and was given this aluminium foil-encrusted brick. And it was a brick because it had been frozen.
Okay.
So let it defrost. it would have been better to leave it frozen. It was absolutely atrocious. So I just kept on trying to work this out, and eventually it was in August 2008, and a thing came out of the oven that had the aroma and the look and the mouthfeel and everything of bread.
Wow.
Thought, right, okay, I've got to first base now. Now where do I go from there?
Yeah.
So it all just developed from there. Just trying to work out with the ingredients that I had at hand that I could get in the local shops and supermarket to make at first it was just a reasonable bread, and then I thought, no, it's got to be a good bread that I can share with other people, because as soon as you say something is gluten-free, you can see people back off, turn up their nose, handle it with tweezers.
Totally.
And one of the first things that happens if you have to go gluten-free is that your social life is affected, because you can't eat with people the way you used to.
Yeah.
Because either you're just paranoid about the food you're putting in your mouth, or nobody else will eat the food you've got to eat.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I had when our kids were little, and it wasn't a gluten free thing, but we had a friend that was with a little girl who was lactose intolerant, and we were always throwing pizza parties, of course, because I had the brick oven, and she always had to bring her little packet of gluten or of lactose free cheese and that kind of thing, and I just thought, oh, this poor little girl has to be so careful about what she eats, you know, and just to socialize and stuff. It is a big deal, and if you're always kind of have to have your food off on the side, kind of a thing, it's not good.
No, it's quite challenging. Yeah. It's challenging enough just for yourself as an adult to sort. For our daughter, though, coming into teenage years, not being able to eat with her friends was a real issue for a kid growing up.
Sure.
Because it just narrowed down the ability to socialize. So she'd come to me and she'd say, the first thing was, Dad, can you make me a nice bread for sandwiches for school? Just so that she could, you know, just eat her sandwiches like every other kid was eating sandwiches. So that was the first thing, and we sorted that out. And then a while later she came to me and she said, Dad, I'm going out with my friends on the weekend, and she said, I'd like to be able to take some hamburger buns with me so that I can get my hamburger in the bun and I can eat just along with them and, you know, everything. So we did the hamburger buns. And a couple of years later, I think it was, she came to me, she said, Dad, she said, it's years since I've had a donut.
Oh, okay.
Do you think you could? So with questions like that coming out, it was game on for developing a whole range of different bread and bread that could be shared with other people, that they wouldn't turn their nose at, that they'd actually come back for more.
Yeah.
And nothing delights me more than seeing bread that I've put on a table in amongst other food that people come back and clean up.
Sure, yeah.
Because it doesn't matter that it's not got any gluten in it. It's just good.
Right, right. my personal experience with gluten-free bread, though, has been more like your experience in Queensland than what I'm seeing from your website or pictures from the book or that kind of a thing. And it's like the closest I ever got to it is I was at Wheatstock in 2018. So the Bread Bakers Guild thing out in Rhode Island and Mac McConnell, who's from California, he's been on the show. We did a gluten-free loaf, mainly based on quinoa. And, you know, with, I think it was psyllium was the kind of like gluten replacement, trying to get some structure in there. And that was the first thing I ever was able to taste that it actually seemed to have the texture, at least of a wheat bread. Didn't have the flavor at all. That was the first and kind of the only time I ever kind of got my head around, okay, here's how you can maybe start swapping things around and moving things around to make a decent loaf. And I'm really curious what's your mental model or what's your philosophy around, okay, how am I going to make a hearth bread, you know, but I'm going to do it without any wheat, any gluten at all. Like what sort of your mindset when you're developing something like that?
Okay. My first principle, coming from the engineering background, I guess, is keep it simple.
Right.
It's got to be kept simple. So the smallest number of ingredients that'll do the job. Okay. The second thing, and I guess it's not one of the guiding principles, but it's a thing that I learned along the way, is don't try and replicate wheat.
Right. Okay.
So a lot of bread that's done as gluten-free bread tries to replicate wheat, and often what they're trying to do, and refer back to that brick in Queensland, is they want to make a white loaf which is like a white, mighty white loaf or whatever the equivalent is in your place, right. Soft and spongy without much crust. And very little in the way of nutrition either. So I keep away from that model of doing things. I don't try to replicate a wheat bread.
Right.
What I look for is a type of bread that I'd like to play with, and then I look for the ingredients that I think, just from my experience with the ingredients, are going to help me build a dough that will make that bread.
Okay.
And sometimes I enjoy just playing around a little bit with the source of the ingredients. So that panettone, a large part of the flour in that is arborio rice.
Oh, okay.
So just, you know, the source of the culture for the panettone, the rice from the same culture, bringing it together and saying, well, this is a new take on panettone.
Right.
But the flavors and so on, obviously with panettone, the main flavoring there isn't the wheat so much as the citrus flavors and everything.
Sure, yeah.
So that's relatively easy to achieve. Building it, using a similar approach and methods to try and get the same, so far I haven't got that same sort of fairy floss pull apart texture,
sure.
But I have got a light texture which does the job.
Right.
So I look at what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I look at what I know about the ingredients I work with, and then I work at building a dough and building a loaf from there.
Okay. And then I guess it seems to me that if you understand how to create the structure that you want, that actually can give you some advantages now in a way that because you get to use a wide variety of different grains and different flours, gluten or not, right? Like I was reading on your website, you know, you're using a lot of buckwheat, using a lot of other things as well. So I guess so gives you the chance to play around with different flavor profiles as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So for instance, if I look at the book, baguettes.
Right.
I've got four different baguettes in
there.
There's one that's made with amaranth. Mm-hmm. It uses amaranth and tapioca starch. It's a long process, but it comes out with a baguette which is recognizable as a baguette, mm-hmm. has a wonderful flavor, different to a wheat baguette, but it has a wonderful flavor. It has an amazing structure. If I move then to what's the next one on the list there, it's a buckwheat and chestnut baguette. Now that has a much closer crumb, but it still comes out as a lovely, recognisable baguette. Mm-hmm. Then there's a rice baguette, much closer in terms of the crispness of the crust. Good open crumb still. My favourite though of the four. I shouldn't say it's my favourite because I do like the amaranth. It's just I can't be bothered mucking around with the amaranth because it just takes so much time to get that result. So that's a sometimes bread. My everyday go-to for a baguette is a millet baguette.
Okay.
Because it's just a simple process and it turns out a lovely baguette which has got a nice soft crumb and a good crisp crust and it works with everything else we eat.
Right.
And it's got a good flavour profile.
Right on. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and is it right to assume that, you know, I'm going to ask really, really dumb questions because this is all brand new to me, but what's the role of fermentation when you're working with a gluten-free loaf? Is it the kind of thing that you still need to ferment for a long time to develop flavor, or is it just more like you can mix this stuff and go?
It depends what you're trying to
okay.
do. If you're using a baker's yeast, yeah. instant yeast or something like that, you can pretty well mix and go.
Right.
I can turn around. What's the quickest one? I've got a buckwheat and herb dinner roll, which I can get on the table from start in about 1.5 hours.
Okay.
And it's beautiful, light, soft, right. Flavoursome. It's good.
Right.
Then again, if I do my homage to Borodinsky, so a Borodinsky style made with buckwheat, 100% buckwheat, mm-hmm. That takes, just let me look up, it takes hours and hours and hours. Here we go. 25 hours.
Oh, my Lord.
From start. Okay. Yeah, okay.
And so what's the effect of time on that, on a formula like that? Like, what's the purpose for the time?
Okay, well, I'll just read down the headings and give you an idea of the time. So preparing the leaven, 5 minutes. So that's starting off with a starter, mixing it into the leaven, and then fermenting that is 8 hours. At the same time as I do that, I prepare a scald, and I malt the scald, and that's that's 8 hours, but it's in the same time. Okay. Then I mix the ferment and the scald together and give them another 4 hours. Build the dough, give the dough 6 hours, shape it, another 2 hours for proving, just under 1.5 hours for baking, and then I have to cool for about 4 before I try and slice it.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yep. So you're probably looking at equivalent sorts of times. The fermentation time is probably a little quicker for gluten-free stuff. Not quite sure why. It could be to do with the mix of bacteria and yeasts. They're similar to what you get with a yeast or with a wheat or a rye starter, but there are some others that are unique to gluten-free grains, and they'll be in different proportions anyway.
Right, sure.
Yeah, and your microbes assemble according to the food that's available.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, and so that's right. And so you're keeping your own sourdough cultures or your own bacterial cultures in the flours that you have that you're using, right? You
know. Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
That's
for
right.
sure.
Yeah. Yep.
No, that makes sense.
Yep. So my, particularly with Promise and Fulfillment, all the work I'd done up until, or nearly all the work I'd done up until then, was based on a single flower starter.
Okay.
And if I wanted more than that single flower in the starter, I would mix the two starters either at the point where I make the leaven for the loaf, or I'd mix two separate leavens and then mix them when I put in the put them in the final dough. Mm-hmm. So I was very careful because I really wanted to keep developing my understanding of what individual starters would do,
right.
Without sort of creating a melange of starters where I couldn't tell what was going on. I could see the result, but didn't know why I was getting the result.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's sort of like you can only have one variable, change one variable at a time too, right? Or else,
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and then techniques like you doing the scalds and that kind of a thing, like what do you see the purpose of that kind of a process being for your baking? Sorry, I'm so sorry.
No,
I promised ahead of time to like geek out with tech questions, but then I'm just so interested in this. Okay.
So normally, if you do a scald, you're aiming to soften the final crumb,
right?
And you're aiming to increase the hydration of the dough.
Gotcha.
Now, with gluten, when you're working without gluten, the dough hydration is going to be high anyway. So why on earth do you want to increase it? Well, there are certain benefits. You can get a better crumb. Mm-hmm. Also, with that particular loaf, for instance, the scald is then malted as well.
Right. Okay. So for flavor.
So that's part of a bigger process. Yeah. So I'm really building the flavor there. There's some others where I use a scald and it's not malted, but it's still it's a different way of adding the hydration into the dough. Mm. So instead of just mixing it straight with cold or tepid water, I'm building that bit of the modified starch and then adding it in later as a clearly modified starch going into the dough with the properties that go with that.
Gotcha. Okay.
I'm just trying to think of others. So I'm playing around at the moment with a shokupan, a Hokkaido bread. I've been doing it for years. What I want to do is produce a really, really good white bread that's still whole grain and is a sourdough and has all the qualities that you would expect in a shokupan or a Hokkaido type milk loaf. And my particular twist on that is that my main flour is a sushi rice.
Oh, okay.
Milk.
Again, lining it up to the culture. Yeah,
that's right. Huh. And I'm gradually getting there. It's just taking time to work out all the twists and turns.
Right. Right.
And that one will eventually be published when I get it, but it's a there's no guarantee which decade that'll happen.
Yeah.
It just takes a long time.
No kidding. Yeah.
And for all of these things, I find it fascinating. So I run a bread group, and I belong to a whole lot of other bread groups on Facebook.
Right.
And for people that started either before me or around about the same time as me, everything that we did was something designed from scratch,
mm-hmm.
because there was just so little around.
Yeah.
So you'd spend a long time developing a dough and working it into the bread that you wanted. Whereas these days people come along and they see something, they say, I'll have that recipe. So just hang on a minute here. You know what it took to get this recipe. but it's becoming far more common. The normal thing is people will develop one formula, one dough, and then they'll try and do everything with one dough.
Right.
I have taken the approach with the book. I've 60 different formulas, 60 different doughs, and when I say it's different doughs, sometimes it'll be the ingredients, the mix of ingredients, and then of course it's the method.
Right.
because the method is just as important as the ingredients.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and that's the, that was the impression that I got in some of the early posts that I saw, right? I think right around the time the book came out, because that was around 2019, right? When
Yeah, middle of 2019.
Yeah, and that's when I remember first seeing it. And it, because the, you mentioned a couple of things that have been kind of going through my mind is that you're exactly right. The call it the wheat bread community and or that kind of thing. It's, I don't know what it was like in the 1980s, but these days it's sort of like, yeah, the formulas are flying fast and furious and techniques are getting shared all over the place and stuff. But the gluten-free world, to me anyways, and I'm not part of it at all. So, but from an outsider, it does look like your book, when you published it, seemed to be a game changer for me, because it was always like hush, hush, big secrets before then. And then here's this fella coming out with a book with like, you know, 60 formulas in it, and 60 formulas and bread that to my eye, like this all looks like this is all real bread. This is, you know, you didn't have to put gluten free on the title or bread without gluten on the title. It was good looking bread regardless, right? And so it seemed like a real game changer to me. And from the, you know, and you mentioned in 2008, you know, you finally get that first one right. So you've got, you know, 10, 11 years of knowledge going into this thing for sure. I'm really curious. So how's the book been received amongst the, like from within the community?
It's been fascinating. Everything from people looking at it and saying, oh, you're just trying to make money out of this.
Oh my God. Okay. Oh, really? Okay.
It's absolutely hilarious. If you ever get into book writing and publishing, and unless you get something that hits the New York Times bestseller list, you don't
make money. Oh, goodness, no. Yeah.
I get about $5 per book for this.
Yeah.
and often I'll get people coming to me and saying, oh, I've got your book. I've just got this one question. And then you spend a couple of hours consulting with them to help them sometimes work out something they just didn't read clearly. And where's your money then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So for those within the community that needs to be without gluten, mm-hmm. It's had some good reception. Number of people who are gluten-free bakers around the world, we formed a good fellowship, right. It's really delightful when you get feedback from somebody that's bought the book, you don't know them, and they say, look, this has just changed the way it's changed my life. I can make bread and share bread, and I can be, yeah. So that side of it's been absolutely delightful. The thing that I hadn't appreciated, and it knocked me over when I began to see it happening, was the impact that it was having on the regular gluten community.
Okay.
And the first time I was at a conference, the Grains Conference, just outside Melbourne.
Right, yeah. That's John Reed hosted that, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yep, that's the one. And I'd been there 5 minutes. I'd registered, and this guy came up to me, took me by the hand and said, oh, I've been hoping to meet you. And he said, I've got your book. I've been reading it. He said, absolutely fascinating, really, really helpful. And I thought, this is nice. And then he went on to explain to me that he actually ran a bakery stateside, and he was learning stuff from, and he'd been running this bakery for years, and he was learning stuff from this book. And I was just bowled over. But by the end of the 3 days of that conference, I was emotionally quite ragged because this sort of thing kept happening.
Oh, wow. So nice.
People that I had never anticipated had got the book, seen the book, read the book, or been referred to the book. And, So when you say game changer, in more than just the gluten-free community,
yeah,
it's really been quite humbling to think that something I put together because I needed to is having an effect far and wide, far beyond what I'd ever anticipated.
And the crossover to the gluten community, I totally get that, because the way I learned how to make bread, you know, and I don't know a ton, like I know what I know, kind of a thing. But it almost shouldn't be possible to do what you're doing. Sort of like the way that so that when you see what you're doing, then it's like, okay, I'm going to learn something that I truly didn't know before, you know, because you're doing to what my ignorant self says is impossible. Here it's possible. So for me to understand what you're doing, I got to learn something. So I can totally see how, you know, traditional bread bakers would be all over this as well. Just from a, it's like, okay, what's going on here? Cause I'm going to have, I'm going to be learning something new. So that's pretty cool. It really is. Well, and also, like, I've only talked with a couple of gluten-free bakers. A woman in New York who doesn't do bread at all. She's doing more, sweets and muffins and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then another fella that I haven't talked to yet, but sort of through a friend referred me on. But both of them talked an awful lot about intellectual property. Like, it's still in this realm of, you know, if I'm going to make this work as a gluten-free bakery, this is all big secrets, you know. Or had another friend back in Regina that opened up her own bakery, and she was using recipes as part of like a franchise model, and they were all hush hush, top secret, got to use it this way. And do you feel that at all? Is that you're kind of breaking down a bit of a barrier and sharing in you know, sharing what you've learned?
Yes. Part of my approach with publishing the book has been very, very intentional to break down that. And you're right, the secrecy around, and I understand the secrecy very well, because that's where I've come from as well.
Okay.
Because it took a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of angst to develop a lot of these
formulas. Sure, yeah.
And it's not been easy. So there's a very, very high degree of personal, financial and emotional investment in it.
Yeah.
And I can understand why people want to keep everything close. And for a long time I did as well, until I got the book ready to go,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't want people to be picking up what I'd done, passing it off as their own. Before I got the book to market.
Right.
After I got the book to market, some of that started to happen. And now I look around social media and see bread that I've designed being used by other people. And it would be nice if there was some recognition. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. But heck, you know, what's it about in the end? And the thing that drove me to do the book was that and it's something some friends pushed me to look at years ago. I started selling recipes, just individual recipes, yeasted recipes, on a thing called Etsy.
Okay.
Online shopping.
Right.
And my friend said to me, look, they said, what you're doing is good. You need to share it. Mm-hmm. At that stage, I was between jobs. And just giving it away was something I couldn't do. If I wanted to develop more, I had to get some income to help me develop more.
Yep.
So I took that model that I would sell recipes rather than just give them away. I don't like the model of putting up a recipe and having all sorts of clickbait around it to get people to go and buy
something. Yeah, yeah.
If I'm going to give a recipe away, I'll give a recipe away, you know. And I do a lot of that, but that's more private. So I had to work out models for selling, so that I could keep developing. But the underlying objective was, when we started out this journey, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. And because, as I mentioned earlier, the social effect on people, and there are lots of other effects as well as just the social effect, of having to go without a major part of your normal food. I want to change that. Yeah. I want to make it easier for people to get good food that they can enjoy together, and food that's nutritious for them. Now, I'm not a dietitian, I'm not a doctor, so I don't make nutrition claims. Yeah. But I do know from what I'm doing, and from the profiles that I can produce in my breads, that they're better for people than the stuff that's all refined starches that you buy in supermarkets.
Yep. Yep.
So, yeah. So sharing it became an important notion. That there are other issues beyond that. When you look at people who can identify themselves as needing to be medically free of gluten, we are mainly in the well-to-do part of the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, this is not a disease of wealthy people. It's a disease of all people.
Right.
So to get good food available to people who can't afford the fancy stuff, it needs to become a general food.
Yeah.
It needs to be out there generally.
Yeah.
So it's a bigger thing. One of the things I'd like to get involved in, I haven't seen a way through to it yet, is projects to, like food banks and all that sort of thing, where good food made without gluten can be made available. Food banks have a real problem, mm-hmm. because they're normally running full-time as much as the resources will allow them, just producing food.
Right.
If they need to produce something without gluten, they've got to do a total clean down of the whole facility, do their gluten-free run, and then go back to their other stuff. So it needs a new approach. Now, some people, it seems, and again, this is talking with researchers, social researchers and medical researchers, it seems that some people who are ill and who are trying to think of the right words without using politically incorrect terms, who are hard up, who are suffering hardship, may well be suffering hardship because they can't digest gluten. It's causing them ill health, and that prevents them from being able to do better for themselves.
Sure.
So there's a whole lot of ideas like that running around in the background.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me. Now, putting out a book, that covers people who like that sort of thing.
Right.
Talk to my wife, and she says, look, just give me a recipe that I can use. You know, don't try and teach me everything. Just tell me what
to do. Okay, gotcha.
And let me get on with
it.
So there's another project going on still in the background a bit at the moment. It's every now and then there's a little glimmer of it comes out. Earlier this year I got accepted into a business incubator.
Okay.
It's called Seed Lab Tasmania. Mm-hmm. It's aimed at small businesses, startup businesses in the food ag sector of the community. The first time we went to an information session, I'm sitting there with Jen, and I said, you know, I was coming in to try and work out how to do better with the book and the knowledge side of it. I said, but with the knowledge that I've got, we could probably put together some very effective bread kits.
Okay.
And put them out in the market so that people don't have to read the book, that don't want to read the book. They can just buy a kit and make some good bread.
Right.
And that's been developing. It got picked up in this incubator. I've had some support in that. In fact, I just noticed before we started, there's an email come in, which is a bit more of the jigsaw puzzle of information I need to get together.
Okay.
The aim is to make a kit, which is a really no-fuss bread kit. So you mix it, you ferment it, you shape it, and you bake it.
Right.
But it's a sourdough.
Okay.
And it's made with either 100% whole grain or a high percentage of whole grain.
Right.
Your listeners won't be able to see
this. Oh, yeah, yeah.
These are some sample kits.
Oh, look at that. Okay.
There's a granary loaf.
Yeah, yeah.
That one is totally whole grain. Now, these are part of my shelf life testing.
Okay.
to see how long I can get a shelf life.
Yeah.
And this one is, you might recognize that one from Instagram, right. That picture.
Yes, yes.
That's a buckwheat country loaf. Delicious, really delicious. One of the things that I noticed, and again, this is one of the differences with that's possible. I won't say that everybody's worked out yet, but it is possible without gluten, is that some of the starters have some very, very interesting properties.
Okay.
Now, in the book, I give the method for making a solid state starter, so a stiff dough starter that you can use to make the panettone, right. Okay. For instance. Okay. Developing that, I've discovered that there are other ways of doing things as well, so that I can use, if I get a little stack of starters here. This one was mixed on the 24th of October.
Okay.
And you can see it's quite solid.
Yeah, it's solid. Yeah.
I can bake a loaf with that today, and it will work. I don't need to refresh.
No kidding.
It.
Huh. Okay.
Yep. Yep. And these are younger versions of the same
right.
thing. These others.
Gotcha.
So that's part of what I've discovered and part of what, at this stage, going back to the question about intellectual property and all that, that will stay under wraps, that the way of getting that one
right.
will stay under wraps, that the earlier one that's in the book is out there. That's fine. But these are different, and they will stay under wraps, and they will probably form the basis, if not these exactly, then some lines of these will form the basis of the kits.
Okay.
That's
really interesting. Yeah. So you can do a baking kit with some of the starter, mix it up and bake it, and away you go, and it's stable enough that you can pull it off and all of that. That's really cool.
Yep.
That's a really cool idea.
Yeah. So that's what I'm working on. It's taken a long time to get here. I'm talking with microbiologists. It's not just a case of having something that works. It's a case of knowing a bit more about why it works, but also knowing that it's safe.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of food safety issues that I've got to make sure we cover.
Oh, totally.
Because if I put something out there and start poisoning people.
Yeah. Which is
the end of the dream.
Yeah. Pretty quick. Yeah. Well, but that's neat that you've got the incubator to work with as well, that's in that kind of ag area, right? So you can maybe get some resources to help you with that. Because, yeah, like I can see how making a food product to sell, even in kit form, a lot of hurdles with that for sure.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. And doing it without gluten, the first thing you've got to do, and in Australia we're a little bit different to some countries, when you do the test for gluten, there's got to be no detectable gluten.
Gotcha. Okay.
We work on a zero. And that makes sense when you look at the studies that have been done to see, you know, how much gluten is a problem. And then if people eat, you know, sort of so much each day, which has an allowable level of gluten in it, it's a cumulative effect. And as they eat more, they end up getting the damage that's done by gluten. So the approach that the Australian authorities have taken is an interesting one. It's more demanding and more exacting. But I think for people who have medical issues, it's a much safer approach. Yeah.
Cool. No, good to know. Well, then it's interesting to me that the work you're doing, and sort of here's something that I can get straight out in the hands of consumers, right? And so that they can go. I'm curious, has anyone approached you in terms of setting up, say, bakery production or that kind of thing? Sort of how to take what you know and help them scale it up in a bakery setting?
I have conversations about that from time to time. Yep. And I was visiting a bakery last week where they would like to move into bread. They do other stuff without gluten, but they'd like to move into bread.
Okay.
And that's a local one that may well happen. I've had conversations with others at a distance, and the conversations are still going on as to how I can help them. And then there are others that have got hold of the book, and I've coached them a bit, and they're doing stuff.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. So I know that the reach of the book has gone far beyond. Some people say, well, why don't you set up a bakery yourself? And I say, well, for a start, I'd go out of my brain if I was baking the same thing every day.
Yeah. No, I hear you.
my interest is in working it all out, making it happen, solving the problem. And if I can solve that and then pass it on to other people, teach them, help them to do it, then I'm also achieving that other underlying goal, and that is to make it available as widely as possible so that people can have decent food.
Yeah. Exactly. And I wanted to bring it back to that because I still think that's the best part of this entire conversation is how you started it, really, with this idea of, like, you know, folks shouldn't have to have, you know, their food off on the side or you know, that it's somehow second best. And it sounds like everything that you've been doing is trying to get healthy food in the hands of the folks that need it, but in a way that they can share it as well. And it's not just, well, this is mine and you can go eat the other stuff. You know, here, this is as good. This is as nutritious, as tasty. Let's go for it. And let's all eat it. So I think that's really neat. I think that's quite commendable, you know, and it's cause it's like, man, I can only imagine the effort that went involved to getting everything together to do the book in terms of setting the recipes. I've got some friends that are authors. And so I kind of know through them how much work it is to actually get a book created and published, which is non-trivial. And now the work that you're doing to build these kits, it's like, wow, that's some serious effort. And so I'm really, I'm really rooting for you. I just think this is like, I hope the kits come to fruition because it would be a really, that'd be really interesting to see, to watch that kind of hit the market and take off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's daunting.
Sure.
There's a lot of work to do, but it's just got so much potential. If I can achieve that, then it'll be a good thing. Well done.
Right. Yeah. Mm. And the books are still in print and available and all of that, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. I self-published and I use the Ingram Spark.
Okay.
Print on demand service.
Okay.
So it's printed in the States, in the UK, in Australia,
okay.
And in other smaller sites around the world.
Right.
It's available online through most of the large online booksellers, some places are, you know, bricks and mortar stores are holding it as well.
Okay.
Yep. And I found I'm selling more and more locally as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. that's always nice when you can. Well, and thanks for sharing the story about grains as well. And actually, you know, meeting folks that have read the book and stuff face to face, there's something to that warms my heart as well. Like just that, hearing that story.
Oh, look, grains is it's a brilliant community. Yeah. And as you say, you've got similar groups in Canada, right, and in the States, yeah, and all that thing as well. And in the UK, I know there's one. I don't know about other nations and languages, right, and so on, whether they have the same things. It'd be sad to think that they don't.
Oh, I'm sure.
But they're just such great communities. Yeah. And grains aims at the growers, the millers, and the bakers. And people that consume as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a really broad community, and it's a fascinating and wonderful community of people. Just such warmth and open heartedness. It's really good.
Awesome.
It's a great crowd of people to belong to.
Oh, cool. Mm. Yeah. Well, and you know, you're manifesting that right now by taking the time to talk to me. And I really do appreciate that, because I'm thrilled that we had this chance to talk. Thank you so much. Because like I say, you know, through social media, through, you know, snippets of hearing about the book and stuff, it was always like, man, this is really, really neat. I'd love to learn more about it. And so I'm glad that we were able to talk. I really am. And I wish you well with the book, but also the new projects, for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you. You bet.
And there you have it. Great talk. What an interesting fella. I was just really, really impressed with the story of why he is working so darn hard to make gluten-free bread of the quality that he's striving for. And this idea of, you know, I want gluten-free bread to be at the center of the table that everybody enjoys, and not just off to the side so as that the poor gluten-free folks have to deal with, you stomach the gluten-free bread, but the rest of us are going to eat this other stuff, right? So that bar is set quite high. And I think he's nailing it. You know, from what I've seen, I think he's nailing it. If I ever get out there, I'm going to taste his bread and prove it. But it looks really, really good. And I'm very grateful. And I know the baking community is very grateful that he's taken the time to put all of this stuff into a book so as that we can benefit from everything that he's learned. So I hope you enjoyed the show this week. I hope you enjoy all the shows, to be honest with you. They're a pleasure to make. They're a pleasure to share. It's a thrill to me to know that folks are listening to this. If you would like to reach out and connect and share some thoughts or just say hi, you can reach me anytime at Mark, M-A-R-K, at riseuppod.com. Or, you know, sign up to Bakers for Bakers. That's bakers4bakers.org. And join a community of bakery owners from around the world talking about the business of baking, talking about the craft, talking about how we make a go of this in COVID, before COVID, after COVID. And really try and keep this beautiful network of small independent bakeries together and thriving and growing. How's that? Until next week, have a great week. Stay safe, stay healthy, work hard. Happy baking. Bye-bye.